Welcome back to Subject to Discussion. I'm Sean O'Mac. Welcome back, White Sox fans everywhere, to Subject to Discussion live on LVRocks.com. It's Wednesday night, 7 o'clock in Las Vegas, which means it's 9 o'clock in Chicago or 10 o'clock in New York City. And this is Subject to Discussion. Email is subject number 2, discussion at LVRocks.com. And a subject of discussion is heard courtesy of the Logic and Broadcasting Network. And tonight's first guest will be Colby Bazell. He's a soldier who served in Iraq and wrote a blog, and he wrote a book, and it's very interesting. I've given it to Mark to read on his trip coming up in a few weeks. And so he'll be on in just a little bit. And then in the second hour, hopefully, I have not heard from him, Justin Gardner from the Dunkelfant Centrist blog will be along with our political roundup. And then ending the program will be our discussion with Andrew Evans, vice chairman of the American Centrist Party. We had the chairman on a month or so ago, and it went over very well. And so I thought I'd bring back the vice chairman now to talk about the American Centrist Party. And subject to discussion is archived over on spankwagon.net. Spankwagon is on every Friday at 7 o'clock Pacific time here on LVRocks.com. And next week will be Gary A. Butts. I'm not kidding, that's his real last name. Founder of ModerateVoters.org. So it's an interesting group. I picked it off of the Moderate Voice blog that Joe Gandelman writes, and it's very interesting, and that group's been around for a while. So we'll bring him on, see what he has to say for himself, and see if we can get a few other guests on. And first of all, before we get rolling with the news to you, I want to mention that tonight after this program, an hour after this program goes off the air, I'll be over at KDWN and AM 720 in Las Vegas co-hosting Wake Up America. That's the show that Mark Edwards hosts Monday through Thursday during the football season, and after football season, it's Monday through Friday from 10 till midnight. So hopefully... anybody out there, you can listen to the Wake Up America program live off the internet. Going to the wakeupamericafoundation.com. There you can listen to the program. I'll be on it. Mark Edwards and Terry Anderson will be on. So, three talk show hosts on one show. I have a feeling I won't get much in, but we'll see. And first of all, I want to talk about the Harry Reid and his BS about closing down the Senate yesterday. That was ridiculous. And we got problems to worry about. And here's Harry Reid pontificating and bloviating on there on the Senate floor, and he's waving his hands. Oh, I'm going to invoke Article 21. I'm going to shut down the United States Senate. Like, ooh, that frightened me, Harry Reid.
Doesn't this almost make you kind of ashamed to live in Nevada?
Yes,
jerk off.
Yep. Absolutely. I've been ashamed of Harry Reid since day one here. I mean, they need to get rid of him. I mean, if we ever need to mobilize with the third party, I mean, that's what Mark Edwards was talking about last night's program, that the Wake Up America is starting to mobilize the political end of the, and that's what we need. We need to get rid of these crooks there. Get rid of Reid. Get rid of Ensign. He's part of the problem, too. He's been there long enough. He's in the Congress and Senate. He hasn't done nothing. Start throwing these Shelley Berkley. Get rid of her. She has done nothing. I mean, you got to start cranking these people up. They've been there too damn long. The accountability, there's no accountability in Washington whatsoever. You know, now you got Libby. Oh, Libby. They're going to, pin this whole Valerie Plame business on him. And, Bush, they say he'll probably pardon him. And then just on and on and on with this stuff. Get down to the order of business with this country. And deficit reduction. We need deficit reduction. We need political reform. I was watching C-SPAN before I left to come here, and I saw that the House actually voted down, which I think is, I don't know if it's good or bad, I think it's good, that would exempt the Internet from Federal Election Commission guidelines for campaigns. So the Internet has been exempted from FEC rules. I think it's good. I mean, they would have put some kind of a restrictions on the Internet. It would have been a chilling effect on the Internet, I believe. So, I mean, just we need to crank these people out. I don't know if it's the American Centrist Party, if it's a combination of them, Wake Up America, a few of these advocacy groups. We need to get these people more accountable. I mean, we got to hold these people to the fire. That they, there's things to be done. you know, this BS going on in Washington's gone long enough. I mean, I hope there's somebody that stands up and says, you know what, I'm sick of this. I'm leaving the whatever, the Democrat, Republican Party. I'm running as a whatever, Deep Space Nine party or whatever the hell it is. But, I mean, something like that. I mean, we need somebody to stand. Hagel, maybe. McCain will never do it. Somebody to stand. Colin Powell will be the answer, but he'll never do it. But somebody has to stand up and says, I'm sick of this. I'm just going to, you know, gonna make take a stand. So we'll see. And I also want to talk about the White Sox winning the World Series. If you weren't listening to the end of the program last week when we went off the air, we broke into the LV Rocks programming with the World Series special report that the White Sox won the World Series in Houston, and they celebrated in Chicago, and I saw the parade. It was great. They Oprah brought them all on to celebrate the win, how it's good for the city, which it is, and they're on Saturday Night Live. Actually, one of them was on Saturday Night Live, Scotty Pazednik. He was on Saturday Night Live doing the weekend update. And then last night, Jay Leno had Ozzy and a few of the others. And then Jerry Reinsdorf and Isaac Ginn cut a huge 600-pound cheesecake in City Hall with Mayor Daley. So I thought that was pretty cool, too. So it's good for them. Good for the White Sox. Good for the city of Chicago. Yeah, it's about time a team that doesn't have a $300 million payroll wins the damn World Series. Yeah, that's the best news. Sox had like a 16th or 17th highest payroll. Good. Yeah. Granted, probably most of the team will be back next year, but, you know, because Reinsdorf's kind of known as a tight ass, but, I mean, that's the way it is. I also want to talk about the president's nomination of Samuel A. Alito Jr. and was largely celebrated by the right and condemned by the left. Of course, you know, business as usual. I looked at the guy; he seems like Judge Roberts. So I mean, I at first glance, I don't seem to have a problem with him. And then tonight we're also going to have our first clue in our Battlestar Galactica DVD contest. I'm going to drop a little tidbit about something about me or whatever. I'll come up with it as I go along. You know, I'm flying at the seat of my pants here in this contest here, but we'll make it up as we go. But no, I'm going to drop two tidbits, like something to do with me and maybe Chicago during the first half hour, and then drop another one during the second half hour. And then we'll do one next week, or the second hour, and we'll do another one next week. And at the end of the program, we'll give away the DVD. So, and now we'll move on to news to you. Feds released details of flu fight plan. This is from today. Faced with how to stretch scarce vaccines and where to put hacking patients. Excuse me. When hospitals overflow, if there is a flu crisis, cities and states are awaiting instructions on President Bush's $7.1 billion plan. States are already got an unpleasant surprise Tuesday when Bush said he wants them, the states, to purchase millions of doses of an anti-flu drug with their own money to supplement the federal government stockpile. Pandemics strike when the easy-to-mutate influenza virus shifts to a strain that people have never experienced before, something that happened three times in the last century. I saw where Bush was on giving a speech about the bird flu, and O'Reilly had it already. He said pandemic 70 times in a 30-minute speech, so wow. Since 2003, at least 62 people in Southeast Asia have died from the bird flu. Part of the agenda, Bush wants to spend $1.2 billion to stockpile enough vaccine against the current flu strain to protect 20 million Americans. $1.1 billion for the drugs Tamiflu and Relenza, which can treat, in some cases, prevent flu infection, enough to treat 44 million people. $251 million for international preparations, including improving early warning systems to spot novel flu strains before they reach the United States. And $100 million for state preparation, so I guess states are going to get some money after all. $56 million to test poultry and wild birds or other flu for the flu virus, bird flu, and other flu strains entering the U.S. bird population. A lot of these birds are coming in through Alaska. So, and a call for Congress to provide liability protection for makers of a pandemic vaccine, which, unlike shots against the regular winter flu, would be experimental and largely untested. So, man, we're really going crazy over this bird flu. You know, there's actually, two cases in Canada already, so it's coming our way. Toronto and then Quebec had one. Asian quake death toll jumps past 73,000. This is from today from the Associated Press. Pakistan's official earthquake death toll jumped by 16,000, and officials warned on Wednesday it is likely to rise further as relief supplies fail to reach thousands of victims stranded in remote parts of the Himalayas. It's freezing cold. It's going to go down like 10 degrees, they said today. Just imagine how many villages and towns became a heap of rubble and how many people got buried, said Major General Farouk Ahmed Khan told reporters. So, wow. I mean, this thing is bad up here with the hurricanes and everything else. Look what's going on over there. I mean, it's horrible. Man, this is from also from today, from, I think it's Wisconsin. I didn't get the location of this. Man kills buck with bare hands in bedroom. For 40 exhausting minutes, Wayne Goldsberry battled a buck with his bare hands in his daughter's bedroom. Talking about being horny, I guess. I don't know. Goldsberry finally subdued the five-point white-tailed deer. It crashed through a bedroom window at his daughter's home Friday. When it was over, blood splattered the walls, and the deer lay dead on the bedroom floor, its neck broken. Wow. Let's see. This guy was at his daughter's house visiting. We heard a glass break, and so he grabbed a hold of the deer and starts grabbing by the neck and strangling it. He gripped the animal and twisted its neck, killing it. So the guy dragged the animal outside the house. And so now the father wants to have the deer processed for its meat. So yeah, that's a good, you know, epilogue there to that one there. You know, I killed the deer and I don't want to eat it now. Yum. I saw this as I was leaving. This one is from CNN. CNN's Aaron Brown leaving the network. Aaron Brown, host of Newsnight with Aaron Brown, once CNN's most prominent anchors, is leaving the network after a shakeup that gives his primetime slot the rising star Anderson Cooper and expands his show to 2 hours. Cooper's old 7 p.m. Eastern show will be filled by an expanded version of The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer. I mean, that damn show, I saw it when I was leaving the house. That show was on again. It was on 3 hours earlier in the day, and it was on another hour at night. I mean, they must want to kill Wolf Blitzer, have him drop dead right there in the set, I guess. I don't know. But poor Aaron Brown. I followed him for years. He was on that ABC overnight, or NBC's overnight program, NBC overnight with Linda Ellerbe, and he went over to do ABC's World News Now. I mean, I liked the Newsnight. I liked his approach, not too pretentious, not too full of himself. Like Anderson Cooper just comes across as some kind of I'm an expert, like Bill Curtis did in Chicago. He kind of like I'm no better. I'm smarter than the rest of you. I don't like the way Anderson Cooper does his newscast. I'm sorry. I like Aaron Brown. I like Wolf Blitzer. He seems like he respects his audience. I just do not like Anderson Cooper. Oh, well. Let's see. Of course, Aaron Brown was vacationing this week. That's a nice little thing. Hit the news while you're on vacation. You know. Aaron Brown went to CNN from ABC in 2001, and he was all over this 9/11 coverage. It appeared he would become the face of the network, but it never really happened. He was hurt by a widely reported story in 2003 that he did not cut short a golf outing to come work on the day that the Columbia space shuttle disintegrated. So, yeah, I remember that. It beat him over the head with that, but, I mean, still, I like Aaron Brown. I mean, he's like an old-time newsman, and it's too bad. This is from Los Angeles from yesterday. City draws a line on animal cruelty. A known gang member convicted of abusing his dog was the first felony case prosecuted with the help of a new animal cruelty task force formed this summer, city officials said today. Aaron Jones of Los Angeles was convicted last month of tying his dog's tail in a knot, dousing her with scalding hot water, and assaulting her repeatedly with a taser gun. That's great. He is serving a three-year sentence. Excluding this guy Jones, this animal, felony cases were filed against four other defendants as a result of the task force action, officials said. Staff have seized 180 fighting chickens, 80 in one location alone, along with cockfighting gear. Several investigations are continuing. I mean, these people being killed, you know, torturing your dog, they dousing the thing in hot water. I mean, horrible. And then we had this one yesterday from a man from Los Angeles as well. A man charged in internet identity theft scam. A 19-year-old Los Angeles man allegedly used a legitimate company's name to trick 2,700 people into providing credit card and personal information over the net, was charged with identity theft. This guy, Hovey, allegedly collected the personal identifying information and excess card numbers of 2,200 people. Why did he do that? Or how did he do it? I guess they don't want to know, or whatever else be doing it too. So, internet. Good thing or bad thing? I'm still in the air about this internet thing. You know, it's good for internet radio, but the rest, I don't know. I still say, if you have a kid,
I put the internet right in the living room so you can see where the hell your kid is at on the internet. Make sure your kid's not in the chat room or anywhere else. I mean, that's the best thing. Being vigilant. Keep that computer in the living room and watch where your kid's going on the internet. This is from yesterday, one of my favorite stories. Priest allegedly performs lewd act in adult store. It's from Worcester, Massachusetts. A Roman Catholic priest arrested in Las Vegas last year for allegedly performing a lewd act on another man inside an adult bookstore was removed from his post as pastor of a Worcester parish. The bishop called this a grave scandal. Let me see here. The bishop allowed him to remain in his post because this priest, Aquino, denied the charges. And McManus, who is the bishop, believed he might have been arrested due to a misunderstanding. And just last week, Aquino, 66, took to the pulpit to publicly deny the charges, telling parishioners he had just entered the adult superstore, which sells sexually explicit books, magazines, and videos, when the police swooped in. Oh, yeah, he mistaked the superstore for a church, I guess. I don't know. Here we go. He goes into Clinton-esque. I want you to know that I've never engaged in any sexual activity of any kind. But that doesn't say he didn't perform sexual activity on that, whoever that guy was. So that's horrible. The police said that they, according to the arrest report, police said for about 30 minutes they witnessed Aquino in a theater at the store masturbating himself and another man in public view. And then also he gave false information to the police. Aquino gave police an incorrect social security number, report said. The guy pleaded guilty to a disorderly conduct charge in March. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, amazing. Amazing. This next one is from the Wisconsin Dells. Dells Outlet Mall will employ 700 people. Developers of a $19 million outlet mall are hoping to capitalize on Dells Water Park tourists. There's a Tanger Outlet Center in Lake Delton. Will have 65 brand stores, Eddie Bauer, Gap, blah, blah, blah. We'll employ 200 people during construction and 700 after the mall's done. So there you go. Everybody's in the Wisconsin Dell. It's nothing but hotels, tourist traps. They have the water park there. They have the rubber house and the helicopter rides and everything. I used to go there when I was a kid, so it was, I liked it up there. This is also from Tuesday. Dog napper caught on tape. Which is these pet stories? I mean, all these dog stories. Dog napping was caught on tape, but this time there is still no sign of a stolen pedigreed puppy, which is worth some $3,000. A woman who allegedly stole the pup was caught in surveillance tape taking the puppy from the Bark and Meow store in Lake Arrowhead around 12:30 Friday afternoon. The puppy is one of three teacup Yorkshire terriers being kept in an open pen in front of the store. Neighboring merchants say they have seen the woman in the area before, but so far no one has contacted the police to provide her identity. So put that dog back. You know, terrible. Buy the damn thing. You know, or to buy something else. Go to the pound. Buy one of from the shelters where he gets put down. This is also from Tuesday. From the EUObserver.com, the European Union to highlight Turkish torture issue. This is from Brussels. Turkey must stop torture, allow freedom of worship, and limit the powers of the military in the next 2 years if it is to join the EU by 2015, according to a draft the European Commission proposal sent proposal seen by the Financial Times. The paper on principles, priorities, and conditions of Turkish EU membership contains 150 short-term targets and will be finalized later this month. The EU has already been screening Turkish legislation for compliance with European law in the field of science, culture, and education after agreeing to start accession talks in October. So the mandate also says the EU can suspend talks if it finds a serious and persistent breach of the principles of liberty, democracy, respect for human rights, and fundamental freedoms, and the rule of law. So they're really going to drag Turkey through the hell there to get into the EU, I guess. Dutch help out Malta on an immigration problem. This is also from Brussels. The Netherlands has agreed to take refugees from Malta following the tiny island state's repeated calls for EU help with the boatloads of sub-Saharan immigrants arriving on its shores. As a first step, the Netherlands will receive 30 refugees from the Mediterranean island group with Dutch immigration authorities also offering to train their Maltese counterparts in handling migrant flows. They have understood our position. They have agreed voluntarily to help us without anything in return. So that should say something. If the EU can handle their illegal immigration, we should be able to handle it here in the United States. You know? This next one is from Massachusetts. Boy, a lot of Massachusetts. Former teacher charged with raping 14-year-old. Woman accused of having sex with teen in car. Mary Kay Letourneau, whatever her name was. A former teacher at a Westford middle school was arraigned Tuesday, accused of raping a 14-year-old male student. News Center 5 in Westford, Massachusetts, reported that Susan Klickner, 47, was hired and, she was fired after an arrest on a charge of statutory rape. Klickner was accompanied to court by her husband. She pleaded not guilty to the charge of rape of a child. Details were not released in court, but Klickner, a former 8th grade, they weren't released out of the News Channel 5 here, got it, News Center 5. An 8th grade science teacher at Lloyd Middle School is accused of having sex with a 14-year-old student in her car in April. The alleged victim told his mother about the alleged incident in July. So, April, May, June, to 3 months. Our prosecutors made reference to the possibility of DNA evidence and asked that she be ordered to stay away from the alleged victim and all children under the age of 16 except her own two teenagers. So, I don't know. We've got numerous calls and letters of support from parents and family members saying what a great job she did. I'm sure she did a great job in that 14-year-old boy, huh? Blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, I don't know. Horrible. Horrible. Grandmother suspected of stabbing baby appears in court. Police say Pepe's found with bloody hands. An Aurora woman accused of stabbing her 20-month-old granddaughter to death appeared in court Monday morning to be advised of the first-degree murder charges she faces. Police say 52-year-old Carolyn Pappas called 911 Saturday to report the stabbing. When officers arrived at her home, she at first refused to open the front door, but when she did, they found her hands covered with blood, and she was still holding a cordless phone. Terrible. How in the world? I mean, this woman must be nuts. Pappas lived at the house with her son, Nicholas, daughter-in-law, Jessica, and her granddaughter, and a roommate. Investigators believe Pappas and her granddaughter are the only ones in the home when the police arrive. Horrible. Horrible. And it's getting close to the holidays, too. Disgusting. And we're here. Airman says commander forced him to remove undergarments. This is not what you think. I thought it was something, my favorite topic, but it's not. This is from Salt Lake City. A Mormon airman claims his Air Force commander threatened to kick him out of his entertainment unit unless he removed his sacred undergarments. Airman First Class Andrew Howells of Salt Lake City said the commander complained that the undergarments worn by the garments worn by observant Mormons showed through his uniform. Howells told the church-owned Deseret Morning News that he finds the situation ironic. Mormons are instructed to wear the white garments, which are symbolic of purity at all times, and remove them only for specific activities. There you go, right there. I guess they are really white and they shine through. I can see the military. I mean, I don't know. And Goop's in the chat room. There he is. And it's behind Strong. Looks like Beavis and Butthead to me. All right. And one more story. Okay, well, I guess we'll bring on Colby. I'm sorry. We'll bring on Colby Bazell. Colby, are you there, sir?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, welcome. Thank you for calling. We're going to call you, but it's good that you called in. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
I must say, I compliment you on your book, and your book is excellent. I bought it on Sunday, and I breezed through the whole thing in 3 days. It was amazing.
Thank you.
I couldn't put it down at all. I mean, what prompted you to write the book?
What prompted me to write the book was, when I was writing in Iraq, I was writing out of boredom. I kept a journal, a field journal, for the first couple months that I was over there, but then I stopped writing in it just because I wasn't really going anywhere. You know, I read my journal, and I didn't really like what I was writing, but then month 8 of my deployment, I read an article in Time magazine discussing blogs on the Internet, and at the time, you know, I was pretty bored with, like, going to the gym and hanging out at the PX and stuff, so I decided to start a blog. And at first it was out of boredom, but then later, looking back in hindsight, I think I wrote for therapeutic reasons. I was able to sit down in front of a computer and just bang away on the keyboard what I was seeing and experiencing, and you know, it was just a way for me to deal with what was going on over there by writing about it.
Actually, I should say, what's this say? Marhaba, is that right?
Marhaba.
Marhaba.
That's,
see,
that's welcome in Arabic.
Absolutely, marhaba. See. And then now at the beginning of the book, you talk about the recruiter, about the Marine recruiter and the Army recruiter. I mean, now and then you, once you got into the Army, you found out that some of the stuff that the Army guy told you was not exactly copacetic, right?
Well, I'm not really going to talk badly about my recruiter because he did everything he could to get me into the Army. I wasn't like the ideal recruit at the time, but I mean he pretty much did and said everything he could to get me into the Army, and yeah, some of the stuff he said, like you know, at first he told me, you know, you weren't gonna, you know, that's good that you're only signing up for 2 years because you probably won't get deployed. And you know, the when you sign the contract, there's something in there about 8 years in inactive ready reserves. And that kind of alarmed me. And when I brought that up to his attention, he said, don't worry about that. That'll only happen if World War III breaks out. You won't get called up. You won't get extended. And I was extended. I was stop-lost. And, you know, but at the time, I don't think he foresaw that. Hmm. But yeah, you just got to be careful when you go into recruiters because you just got to have this mentality of, like, you know, they're lying to you, but it's kind of like buying a used car. Like, you just hope the used car works. Mm-hmm. But you know he's going to say everything he can to sell you that used car.
Yeah. Now in your book you say that after you're in for a while, they sent you back to your hometown to you do some time at the recruiting office. I mean, how'd you feel about that, that they're using you to bring more people into the Army?
I didn't like that at all. I mean, I just wanted to go in, do my time, and yeah, I'm really bad at sales. Mm-hmm. Like, I worked a couple jobs where it was like I worked at a gift sales store. And, you know, they teach you how to sell stuff to customers, and I really hate doing that. And basically they wanted me to be an assistant for them and go out to a local community college. And, I mean, this is Northern California, and at the time we were, like, just got done with Afghanistan. And so the whole community college looked like, you know, UC Berkeley in the 60s, all this anti-war sentiment all over the place, and here I am dressed in my Army Class A uniform trying to recruit these people, and these people are just not interested at all in joining the military, and you know, I mean, they kind of looked at me weird for being on their campus and stuff. That was kind of weird. I mean, I would never talk someone out of joining the military, but I think that if someone wants to join, they should join. But I don't like, you know, I don't like the idea of selling the Army to someone who doesn't want to, you know, not really interested in it, and hype it up for more than what it is.
Yeah. Now, how do you feel? Do you regret ever not going into the Marines?
Actually, the Marines, I don't know. I mean, if I would have joined the Marines, I would have been in for 4 years. That's their limited, their smallest enlistment time. But their deployments are only 6 months. In the Army, I was able to do 2 years in the Army, but one of those years was spent in Iraq. Actually, it was a blessing in disguise. I got lucky. I mean, there's a lot of good people in the Army. And, you know, we had some of the best equipment ever, you know, the best equipment out of all of them. And, I got really lucky. No, I have no regrets at all about joining the Army. In fact, I got lucky. Yeah, my first choice was the Marines. But if I would have joined the Marines, I would still be in the Marine Corps right now. I got real lucky having that Army recruiter persuade me into joining the Army. He persuaded me by the $4,000 enlistment bonus and 2-year enlistment. Yeah. But what he didn't tell me about the $4,000 enlistment bonus was it gets taxed and it's broken down into monthly installments, and I didn't find out about it till later.
What do you feel about that? I mean, we've heard stories that, you know, some of the recruitment centers, they you know, they go out and you know, you saw, what was that movie with Michael Moore? He did, you know, they did that segment where the recruiters are out there. Oh, we got banned. You can, you know, I mean, what do you feel about it? Do you think the recruiters should be more honest with what they're in for if they enlist?
Well, if they were totally, completely honest, I don't think a lot of people would enlist. I mean, a lot of people enlist for college money and educational reasons. And, you know, there are some people that look at it as an adventure and they want to get deployed. And they do kind of, from my experience, they kind of do make the Army sound like a country club or a Club Med vacation in ways. But the Army, I mean, you know, you don't have to worry about buying groceries or rent or a lot of the other headaches that I had when I was a civilian. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a good job for a lot of people. I made a lot of good friends there. I really don't have anything negative really to say. I mean, there's the stuff that they told me that wasn't true, mm-hmm. but overall, I mean, it was a good experience for me.
Yeah. Actually, Mark, the producer's got a question.
Yeah, what was your MOS, your job?
11 Bravo. I was a trigger puller. Ooh. I was in the infantry. I was M240 Bravo, fully automatic machine gunner for my platoon.
Yep. Now, you talk about when you first got there. Now, MOM progresses along. Now, when you first signed up, did you find that in the Army you had to change your life. You couldn't be in every day. The discipline. How did you feel about that discipline when you first went in?
Actually, I adapted pretty well.
I mean,
when I went into basic training, there was guys that cried and broke mm-hmm. down every day and stuff. But, I mean, the way these drill sergeants would yell at me and stuff, I mean, it was kind of like my mom. My mom used to always yell at me, and, like, she'd tell me to clean the room or do a chore. And no matter how well I cleaned my room or did whatever chore she told me, it was never up to her standard. Hmm. And it was the same with the drill sergeants. Like, they'd tell a private, fix your bed, and the private fix his bed the best he can. He would look at it, and it wouldn't be up to his standard. He'd flip the bed over and tell him to redo it, and I'd see people break down and couldn't deal with that. And then when it happened to me, and be like, you know, this is just like my mom telling me my room's not clean, you know, big deal, you know. And I just kind of, basic training didn't really change me that much. Mm. I mean, a little bit, but overall, no, not really.
How did it affect you seeing the other soldiers next to you breaking down and all that? I mean, it had to be kind of like, you know, what the hell's going on here? You know what I mean?
A little bit about that, but also you see other people breaking down, but it kind of builds you up a little bit. You see them not being able to hack it, but then you're like, okay, I'm going to push it even more and not do that, and it kind of motivates you. It motivates a lot of other people seeing other people break down, but it does mess with you a little bit, but I think it encourages you as well.
Yeah, now in the book, you're saying that when you first enlisted that your Stryker Brigade wasn't originally supposed to go to Iraq, and you were, you know, kind of mad that you weren't going to go to Iraq, but then when they said you were going, how did you react to that?
I was kind of excited. I mean,
really?
The reason why I joined the Army was it was a break from the temp work and the dead-end jobs, and I wanted to do something with myself. I wanted to do my 2 years, come back as a veteran, and say, you know, even if I do, you know, go back to remedial jobs and all that stuff afterwards, I could at least say I did something with myself while I was here. And you know, I wanted to go, you know, on the great adventure, which was, you know, some people say war is. And you know, I was excited. Not for political reasons or whatever. I just looked at wars, going overseas to the Middle East, as being an adventure.
Yeah. And now you talk about that. You got married before you went over. You know, how'd that come about?
It was actually I got married in Vegas. When I did hometown recruiting, I found out that there's something called BAH, which is basic allowance for housing, which pretty much if you're married and you live in the barracks, you get paid almost twice as much as if you're just an enlisted soldier. So I told my girlfriend at the time, hey, you want to go to Vegas to get married and, you know, we'll split the money or do whatever. And she's like, yeah, sure, no problem. Just save the money and stuff. So she was cool with it, so we both met up in Vegas, went to a little place where the city where you get the certificate thing, and then we went to a drive-through wedding chapel and ordered the to-go wedding.
There you go.
And, you know, got married, said our to-dos and stuff. The chaplain came out, put his little speakers, you know, played some church music, and, you know, we said our I-dos, and, you know, we were married, and I turned in the certificate, and, we're still married.
Well, congratulations.
Everything's cool.
Yeah, because a lot of military marriages don't last. I think you even mentioned in your book that it's not, you know, if you're married when you go into military, you won't be when you come out, or, you know, vice versa, right?
Yeah, I had a drill sergeant say that one time. If you came in the military married, you won't be when you come out.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the reasons is the contract marriages. You know, hey, if you want to get married with me, I'll split the money with you. Yeah, sure. And a lot of people get married too soon. I think there's an infidelity problem in the military. And there's a lot of divorces for various reasons, but you know, there's also a lot of happily married people in the military. I think it's no different than regular society.
Well, you should be honored, though, because you know what? Because at drive-through wedding chapel you went through was also when that Triple H got married to Stephanie McMahon on in the WWE.
He's a big wrestling fan.
I'm a big wrestling fan. Actually, you mentioned your book, Caesar's Palace. I work at Caesar's Palace, so, yeah.
Really? That's where we spent, that's where we stayed at, we were doing some gambling. You know?
That's why that room had...
We gambled while we were getting married, but we also did some gambling.
Is that why that room had to be remodeled, I think, after... Any, Marcus, question?
Yeah, it was pretty funny. When I was in aviation in the Army, and we used to call the divorces and everything, we called it AIDS, aviation-induced divorce syndrome.
Now, when you went over to it, when you first got to Iraq, I mean, how was your perception versus the reality of that country? And when you first arrived, like, man, this is one big heap of sand, huh?
Yeah, I mean, before that, I mean, the only other... I've never really been outside of California. I mean, I went to New York and traveled a little across the U.S., but I've never been outside the country. And then, to go straight over there, I mean, it felt like I was on a National Geographic expedition or something. You know, see these people commuting by donkeys and, like, you know, all these beat-up cars and, you know, kids playing soccer. I mean, it's kind of a third-world country and stuff. I mean, it was a big culture shock. No one speaks English. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, and now, how'd you feel you mentioned how the first handful of soldiers you're with that died in it's like a freak accident with their they end up rolling over into a stream or something and they're trapped.
That was our very first combat mission. We just convoyed up into Iraq from Kuwait, and we were in a city right outside of Samarra in the Sinai Triangle, and it was our first combat mission. It was just some traffic control point. And, we're all in the motor pool before the mission, getting ready. We're listening to, like, music. You know, one of the strikers is playing Metallica's Seek and Destroy. Everyone's got their digital cameras out, taking pictures, group shots. Everyone's all excited to go. And then finally we load in our vehicles, and we're driving, leaving the base to do our mission. And all of a sudden, like, over the radio, they tell us to stop. And one of the vehicles got in an accident, and we stopped and waited. And then we realized, we heard over the radio that one of the vehicles accidentally went into a ditch that had water in it and was flip-sided and on its back, and they were submerged in water. And at first we were told there was four dead, and then one of the guys was dead, but somebody did CPR and revived him. But the other three soldiers drowned to death on our very first mission.
That'd be hard for you, huh?
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, we all went back to the base, and I'll never forget that night. Everyone was kind of walking around. People were totally. I know I was. I was kind of messed up from that for a couple of days. And one of the guys was a good friend of mine, Specialist Blinkenstaff. And before we listened to the same music, we hung out together. Before we went to a bar in Olympia, before we went over there, and we'd always talk about music. I'd borrow CDs from him, and then he was, a good guy. And then our first mission, he passes away, and I don't know, never forget him.
Well, then you also talk about that you did not want to write the letter to your family. They asked everybody to write the letter back to your family before you leave?
Yeah, I mean, before we went into the Sinai Triangle, the Sinai Triangle was heavily infested with insurgents, and our job was to clear the city. And our PL told us all, he wanted us all to write a death letter and have it on our physically on us in our vests, so that way if one of us dies, our buddy could mail the letter back to either a wife or the family. And a lot of the soldiers in my platoon were like, they thought that was a morbid idea and wouldn't do it. And some did write the letters, but yeah, I wrote a letter. But I the thing about war is you develop a kind of a sick sense of humor to deal with it. And I wrote, "Dear Mom and Dad, you're right. I should have gone to college instead. Love, Colby." And that was my letter. And I showed it to all the other guys. Everyone got a ha ha out of that. But, and I did have the letter on my vest for a little bit, but then, I crumbled it up and threw it away after a couple of weeks. It kind of creeped me out having that thing physically on me because after a while, you start realizing, you know, what if my parents get that letter? You know, that wouldn't be too cool.
Yeah, how did you? I mean, you may go to Iraq, and of course, you have to like acknowledge that you possibly won't be coming back alive from this. How did you register that in your mind? I mean, how do you just like, well, I could go out, I could not be coming back. I mean, did you just go out and do your work and come back and not think about it, or was death always kind of lingering?
Kind of, I mean, I was in the infantry, so like we go on multiple missions a day, like leaving the base, and every time you leave the base and you leave that wire in the back of your head, I think everyone thinks this is like, you know, is today the day I don't come back? Is it today the day I lose my arm or my legs? Is it today the day, you know, something happens to one of my friends or something? And I think, well, for me, you just block it out of your head. I mean, you think it every time you leave that base. But you block it out, and you know, it goes into that weird sense of humor that you develop over there as a way to protect yourself and to deal with it. Hmm. But yeah, I mean, you just block it out of your head completely, and you block it out and deal with it later, kind of thing.
Hmm. Good. You have a question?
Yeah, I was whenever we'd get brought up on alert and everything, and we'd have to get ready. The pastor, I can't remember what the hell his name was, he used to come back down through and ask us to write our death letters, basically, because, I mean, just us mobilizing, we usually, like, lost a few people just going to training exercises. And I always thought of that as, like, something that we just did. You know, it wasn't, they didn't come by and say, oh, you have to do it, but it kind of became normal, you know. Because training exercises, our battalion lost 3 to 4 people every single time we went out on just a training exercise to Fort Irwin.
Mm-hmm. Really? Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the casualties that happen in Iraq are just normal, not like the, you know, accidents that happen. You know, a helicopter will go down for whatever reason. I think a lot of the deaths out there are for, you know, I mean, accidents do happen and people die and stuff, but... But I don't know. I mean, I didn't see a lot of people writing death letters we weren't told to do it. We were encouraged to write a death letter. But, but I don't know. Everyone has different ways of dealing with it.
Now, how'd you deal with it? Like, as you go on, you look around the barracks, and there's an empty bed there that wasn't before, an empty one there. Just the environment must have been kind of rather chilling. I mean, I don't know how you could sleep at night knowing, you know what I mean? It's just, I don't know. I respect everybody that goes into the armed forces. I don't know how I'd be able to survive that. The lingering not knowing over your head every day.
Yeah, I think everyone deals with it personally and in their own ways. Yeah, everyone just deals with it personally and quietly in their own ways.
Hmm.
And I think you deal with it once you come back.
Yeah. Did you find religion, or were you more religious coming out than you were going in?
I don't know. I mean, as that old saying, you know, there's no atheists in the foxholes, but, you know, there's no angels in there either. You know, I didn't find God out there. I know a lot of people went to church and all that stuff and, you know, carried the rosary beads and Bibles and all that. You know, I mean, there was one time, you know, when I was told to load up a 50 cal during an ambush, and we were getting shot at, and there was RPGs flying in the air, and, you know, I did the sign of the cross and did a prayer, you know, saying, please God, I don't want to die today, kind of thing. You know, so yeah, when your life's in danger, yeah, it's interesting how quickly you find God and do a prayer.
Hmm. No, go ahead.
Did you ever think about re-upping into a different job or anything after you your time was up?
I don't know about a different job. I mean, I love the infantry. I mean, it's physically demanding, and that part of the job I didn't really care for too much. I did thought about when over there at one time extending, just because I was stop lost, and I thought about maybe ending my deployment by extending, but then I changed my mind once they told me if I extended, you'd be on Humvees patrolling downtown Missoula.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, anyone that's over there that's seen Humvees, you know, even the up armored Humvees, it's kind of a going out on suicide missions, and you get hit by an IED, and it'll just, you know, crumple up the Humvee like it's a beer can.
Yeah, I truthfully, I don't even know why that they even sent the Humvees in to begin with.
Yeah,
I
have no
was
idea why they do that either. It's stupid and it's suicidal, and there's no reason for that. Well, but they're still sending guys out on these Humvees, and they're easy targets, and and even the up-armored, you know, the 155 IEDs will totally tear apart.
Yeah, they will.
Kill and maim all the soldiers in there. And the thing with the body armor is the plates is they're over the vitals of the body. So you get hit with an IED, you'll lose your arms and legs.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Every time on that base when I saw guys leaving the base on Humvees, I always felt sorry for them, you know.
Yeah, that whole the deuce and a halfs, the covered troop transports and all that.
Yeah.
I've always been against that. Main reason was one of my friends, John Warmber. He was in Somalia, and he was with 10th Mountain over there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going out on a convoy, and they got ambushed. They got hit from both sides, and they took their truck alone took like 23 shots. He was a M60 gunner. And he jumped up on top of the deuce and a half, which is like the worst thing you could ever do is just throw the gun over the roof of it because there's the big windows. So, anyone that was looking from one side that they were turned to because they did the wishbone formation where one truck goes this way, one truck goes that way. He was firing off into the side, but nobody was blowing the dismount whistle, so he didn't think about it. And when he jumped off, he realized right at that second what he had been doing. And his knees just crumbled underneath him, and he busted up his knees and, like, crawled over to the ditch. And that's where I was talking about the re-upping. He said he heard the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard in his entire life, and it was two Cobra helicopters coming over.
I was just going to say, air support?
Yep.
You know? Yeah, that is... The best sound you'll ever hear in a situation.
Yeah,
like
the little 1.75-millimeter rockets flying out. And he's just like, that was the most... That's how I actually met him, was he ended up in aviation with me because he re-upped after he got back from Somalia and went into aviation, and I was in Fort Gordon, Georgia, going to school with him.
Really? Right on.
Now, how was it adjusting the life over there in Iraq? Now, you talk about your book about internet cafes and stuff there. I mean, are you surprised that, like, the modern United States society kind of came to you guys there, or what?
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that they allow internet cafes over there. I mean, you hear stories about, like, phone calls being monitored, pictures being censored, and letters being blackened out and going through monitors and sensors. And, you know, with the internet, you could pretty much, you know, say whatever you want in real time and email people and post a blog or do all this stuff, which is, I thought, unheard of. And, like, when I read that article in Time Magazine, it said there were soldiers in Iraq blogging. I was like, no way. There's no way the military would allow such a thing to happen. And I went and looked, and there was a handful of blogs. I mean, I don't think the Army really... I think now they're really cracking down on these soldier blogs, and I know you have to register and have it approved with your chain of command first before posting anything on the internet. So they are kind of getting up with dealing with that. But I'm still shocked with the amount of freedoms that these soldiers have in regards to expressing themselves.
Wired did a huge piece about it.
Yeah, why are you talking about the military blogs and all that as well?
Mil blogs. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, because in your book you mentioned how you read some of them, and you said, you know, this is crap. These guys aren't telling how it really is over here. So that got you the inspiration to start your own, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is when, like, I was there for OIF, too, so there's only a handful of blogs up on the Internet, and a lot of them look like that they were written by soldiers who didn't really go out on any real missions, and they were writing on their blogs like, you know, they were Rambo or something, or like, you know, this whole, you know, just the stuff that to me, it didn't really sound like they knew what they were talking about. And I've looked and trying to see if there's anybody in the combat arms, you know, that went out and went out on missions, and I couldn't find any. So I was, without even thinking about it, I was like, you know what, I'm going to start one up right now and just write what I see and what I'm experiencing, and you know, forget about all that politics and why we here, you know, all that stuff. Just write about what I'm experiencing. So, you know, and then people kind of got a taste of what it was like there, you know, by what I was writing and stuff. But yeah, I had, you know, I mean, and it kind of blew up after a couple of weeks. I was getting like thousands and thousands of hits. And, you know, at first I didn't think there was a lot of people reading these blogs. I thought maybe a dozen most. But it ended up being thousands and thousands of people. It's weird.
Yeah, were you surprised that you're reaching so many people? I mean, in your book you mentioned about the emails you're getting from people asking questions. Would that surprise you?
It shocked me. I was getting emails from all over, like Europe, South America, America, Afghanistan, Kuwait, other soldiers on the base, the helicopter pilots that went, you know, they'd read my blog, they're like, whoa, we were the helicopter pilots on that mission, you know, wow. You know, it shocked me, and it was kind of overwhelming getting all those emails from people.
Now, those pilots are an odd group of people, aren't they?
They're cool, man. I mean, I wish if I was going to reenlist, I'd want to be a combat helicopter pilot. I think they have a pretty cool job. I mean, they work a lot. I mean, they're always flying and stuff. But I mean, I think they have a pretty cool job. You know, flying overhead and you know, like those. Apaches, you know, they're just like overweight with all these missiles and you know, guns. I don't know.
Now,
but they do get shot at a lot. I mean, they're always taking RPGs and small arm fires. I mean, it is a dangerous job for them, but I mean, it's an important job.
Yeah, I mean, over in Iraq, you start, you know, interacting with the people. I mean, are the people more or less glad to see when you were there? Glad to see you all there, or as the press here likes to say, you know, they're you know, they all hate us. They want everybody to go.
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out. I mean, when I was over there, you know, I mean, you go through a neighborhood, they're all cheering and they're all clapping that you're there, but then the next minute they're throwing rocks at you. One minute you'll meet an Iraqi saying, you know, thank you, you know, thanks for being here, and they'll give you a gift or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then the next minute, you know, they'll give you another Iraqi will give this dirty look, and you can tell that he doesn't want you there. And it's a little bit of both. You know, there's a lot of people that like us there, and we are doing a lot of good there, but there are a lot of people that don't want us there. Mm-hmm. We were there after the party was over, kind of like when they got Saddam and the 28th Baghdad thing was over, so the party was kind of over when we were there. And I don't know. I mean, a lot of people are thankful that we're there, but there was also a lot of people that didn't want us there, weren't appreciative.
Were you surprised at the strength of the resistance? I mean, everybody seems like they're, you know, they're shocked at, you know, the strength of the resistance after they rolled into Baghdad, and then, you know, nothing happened, and then all of a sudden, you know, this resistance popped out of nowhere, seemingly, huh?
Well, it's guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, it's guerrilla warfare where it's not, I mean, they know if they fight us one-on-one in a battle, they'll lose, so it's guerrilla warfare where they just shoot and disappear. They fight dirty. They plant an IED. They'll attack one day, but then the next attack won't be for a month or two. They know how to string it out and to just nibble at us in these small attacks, and don't do maybe every now and then a big offensive, but it's just, you know, just shoot and disappear. These people blend in with the local populace. They're completely invisible. You don't know where they're at or even if they're around. And they always attack when you least expect it. And, you know, and when they do attack and then you piece it all together, you realize that, whoa, these guys were watching us. They were following what we were doing, and these guys are a lot smarter than we think. It's frustrating, you know. You get hit and they're gone. And they're nowhere in sight. And you're like, what the heck just happened? How do we fight this?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned about the smoothie store there that's run by the Iraqis. I mean, were you kind of like, oh man, this, you know, how'd you trust this Iraqi to give you a smoothie? You know, back in your head, kind of said, you got to be thinking this guy's gonna blow us up, huh?
No, not really, because the Iraqis that worked on the base, I mean. You can't trust anyone over there. I mean, that's the big mistake. But, I mean, there was a lot of Iraqis that were really thankful. They're cool people, a lot of them. Some of our interpreters were some of the best people I've ever met, really thankful, really down to earth. You could talk to them, and they're just like talking to a friend back home. There was a lot of Iraqis that were extremely cool to us.
And you got another one? Question?
Oh, was there ever a time when local Iraqis could you tell that they knew that some of these people were around that weren't from their country but were the ones that were attacking you? or did they just seem oblivious to it and not really care?
I don't know, not really care. I think they were oblivious to it. I know when we do patrols and missions, sometimes the interpreters would come up to us and be like, hey, be careful. This is a bad neighborhood. You know, a lot of insurgents here. I mean, they know what neighborhoods are bad and which ones are good. You know, it's usually the really poor parts of towns because there's, you know, there's not a lot of jobs. There's not a lot of money floating around. So what these insurgents would do is they'd pay people to attack us. They'd be like, yeah, if you go mortar the Americans, we'll give you, you know, X amount of dollars. If you go plant an IED, we'll give you X amount of dollars. So a lot of these people, because they're living in poverty and have no money, would do these attacks on us for money. I think that they were oblivious to the... But they did tell us that a lot of these people that are coming over, I mean, these are from the interpreters that lived and grew up in Iraq, would say a lot of these people that are causing the problems are people that crossed the borders from Iran and Syria. They didn't think that they were Iraqis. I'm sure a lot were, but the impression I got from the interpreters were a lot weren't.
Now coming back from there, now, did you have a hard time, you know, did you miss Iraq when you came back?
No,
really?
No, you talk,
because you talked to some soldiers, like, I had a hard time, you know, it was a bitch adjusting back to regular life because I actually missed it over there, you know what I mean?
Well, I missed the camaraderie, yeah. I missed the friends that I was there with. I mean, it was the worst of times and the best of times. It was a great experience. I have no regrets. I'm glad I did it. But would I want to do it again? No. No. No, I mean, I've heard that a lot, too. I know there's some people that are eager to go back because I know I've been back for a little over a year now. It's been pretty difficult coming back and adjusting to being back. It doesn't seem like we're a country at war over there. And I've read something in Time magazine where it's saying, you know, if the Korean War is the forgotten war, then the Iraq War is the invisible war. And that's what it feels like. You go over there, you do a year over there, you go through all these things, and you come back, and it just seems like, you know, life goes on here, and no one really gives a darn about what's going on over there and the sacrifices that the guys are making over there. And I think that messes with a lot of the guys that went over there and served, and just to come back and realize that, you know, you get the impression that no one really cares, and
well,
I think that kind of messes with you.
Yeah, well, there's so much, you know, BS going on in this country. You know, they're all obsessed over, you know, American Idol and, you know, the Supreme Court.
Well,
and all this BS.
Everyone's trying to politicize everything.
Yeah, everything gets politicized.
If someone sneezes.
Yeah, and then I always found in May, I've said since I started this program, going into 2 years now, that we have what, 3 24-hour news channels, yet they cannot seem to cover more than one story at a time, which is amazing. Why can't they devote, you know, a half hour, an hour to what's going on in Iraq, the good and the bad? We get all the bad.
Well,
you
get the war, you know, stories from Oliver North.
Oh yeah,
and he talks a lot about
the stuff
that's over there.
Old
no, he talks about
Warified war stories. And
well,
stuff,
no,
right?
not the old stuff, but he does go over there and he'll sit there and interview like 3 or 4 soldiers, even like a couple weeks ago he did it.
Really?
Yeah, I mean he's back and forth from there like every other month, so.
Yeah.
He tries to keep up with it. He tries to make sure that people really understand what's going on.
Well,
that's what we need. We need more people like him that are going over there and talking to troops and going out there and experiencing what they're going through and reporting it to them. I mean, the people back here would be shocked if they knew what those guys over there are going through on a daily basis. And, like, you know, you pick up any newspaper, the war is like third and fourth page news, and it's reported in these small desensitizing blurbs where it just says IED attack happened in Baghdad, 20 dead, 20 civilians dead, 40 injured, 1 U.S. casualty, and then that's it.
Yeah.
And if they got the whole story of what happened, and if they was able to put a face to the war, I mean, I think people here would I think a lot of, you know, things would be different if people really, you know, knew what was going on. I mean, this whole Green Zone reporting, you send an embed to the Green Zone and just reports on these press conferences.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of malarkey.
Yeah.
I mean, they should have
embeds.
people over there reporting, at the beginning of the war, there seemed like there was a flood of embeds to go over there, and they all wanted to cover the war, and then they all came back and wrote their books. And then, you know, for the most dangerous parts of the war, year two and three, you know, the whole time I was in Mosul, I didn't see a single embedded reporter there. Everything was reported by, you know, these press releases the Army would give. Yeah. They would hardly say anything at all. So I don't think people back here have any idea what's going on.
No. Anderson Cooper, he wasn't with you? Anderson Cooper from CNN, he wasn't with you?
No.
I mean, that guy is all over. I can't stand him. You know, he drives me crazy. He's one of these holier-than-thou reporters.
Okay. Really?
Do you watch CNN?
No.
Oh, my God.
I know when I first got to Mosul, there was a story going around that Geraldo went out to Mosul.
Yes.
And he wanted to go out in the streets, and on his very first day, he was shot at.
He got shot at, and then he was giving away the troop location.
Oh,
that's why they
pulled
him back.
If you could get any troop location off of that little squiggle he made in the dirt.
I think the military just got sick. I think the military just got sick of Geraldo and his BS, right?
I guess Saddam probably could have gotten it out of, you know, one of those RVs that had satellite TV, because they knocked out every goddamn TV system that they had in the whole country. So.
Yeah. Well, Colby, we're out of time here. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. God bless you for being back, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Right.
You're welcome. Bye. And that was Colby Bazell, author of the book My War. Sorry, we went a little over our time here. And outstanding. He's a good guy. The book is outstanding. I recommend everybody to, if you can, go out and buy the book, rent it from your library. And coming up next after our little break would be hopefully it'd be Justin from the Dunkelfant and then Andrew Evans from the American Centrist Party. This is Subject to Discussion on LVRocks.com. And don't forget to join me at 10 o'clock for Wake Up America on KDWN AM 720. We'll be right back.
Desire, why I'm
And welcome back to Subject to Discussion. That's the old Subject to Discussion entrance music there. That was brings back memories. I envision Debbie Hall sitting in front of me now. But Ann will be joined in a minute. We have our sound effects for our... there he goes. We still have our elephants. We haven't gotten the elephants yet?
No, I can't find any elephants.
We got Justin here from the Donkelfent. You there, sir? There you go. We're still searching for some elephants. We've had an elephant sitting across from us for like 3 weeks here, but he's gone now. But
he's in the chat room.
He's in the chat room. He's not listening though. But anyway, so what's going on? This is Justin from the Dunkelvent, the Centrist blog extraordinaire.
Nothing much. In my life, but quite a bit in the political arena.
Yes. The big dust-up yesterday with the Democrats, with Harry Reid, Pinky, as they call him here in Vegas. Rush calls him something else, but in Vegas, his nickname is Pinky. I don't know if you want to write about that. You're welcome to, but that's his nickname.
Why is his name Pinky?
I don't know. I mean, every time he runs for election, he trots out these commercials with all his old friends saying that, oh, Pinky, his name, nickname. We all call him Pinky for some reason. I don't know why, but his nickname is Pinky. So, what was the reaction to that about Harry Reid's blindsiding the Republicans, huh?
It was mixed. There were cries of joy on the left and mm-hmm. on the right. It was called political grandstanding. Mm-hmm. I mean, pretty typical, right? You know, somebody pulls up something like that and, you're going to get people on either side saying, like, you know, yay and nay. And I don't know. I think it's kind of interesting. I thought it was really it completely pulled the coverage away from Alito. Mm-hmm. It focused it back on the Iraq War. I'm not going to go into the some would say type of thing. I think that actually Reid made a pretty good point that Roberts hadn't conducted or given the report on the second phase of the investigation of the pre-war intelligence, and that's essentially what he was doing that for. Now it was very stuntish. I mean, no doubt about it. Yeah. But it was a great bit of political theater, and I did blog about this. If Dennis Hastert can hold open the vote in 2003 on the Medicare bill for 3 hours when it was supposed to be 15 minutes, I think Harry Reid can invoke a congressional rule to, you know, talk about something that, could potentially be, some classified stuff. So yeah. I just think that, he did his thing and, they're gonna say that the Democrats have no good ideas, and Democrats are gonna say the Republicans are not living up to what they said, and that's just how it is.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think that the Democrats have to come up with some proposals to counter the Republicans. They can't just say, he's full of crap and this and that. You got to come up with some counter ideas to what the Republicans are doing. You know, and so far, Reid and all of them haven't come up with anything. I know, what's his name? Who's the head of the party now? Jesus, the governor of Vermont with... his name.
Howard Dean.
Howard Dean, that's it. I almost forgot.
Mr. Dean.
he's been running the party. Where's his ideas? I understood they're supposed to come up with like a contract with America type of a thing, but they haven't come out with that either. I mean, it's a mess.
Well, here's the thing. There were ideas back in the election. Mm-hmm. And they haven't really been able to put forth much legislation because it's a completely Republican-controlled Congress. I mean, it is straight up controlled by the right. Mm-hmm. And then it's really hard to start to push your stuff out of committees and then get it rolling in the House and the Senate. So that's one of the reasons why you don't see a lot of their quote unquote ideas out there. Mm-hmm. That's just how it is, right? I mean, when you're the ruling party, when you're the majority party, you just get your stuff out there and you're passing that stuff. So I mean, they have ideas. I'm curious to see what their quote unquote contract with America is going to be. But
who knows? I don't even think.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows? But I think
they don't know either.
Right now, well, I think they probably do. They're probably just waiting for the right time to pull it out.
Yeah.
And I think they're probably going to pull it out. It's going to have some type of tie-in with the 2006 midterm.
Oh, that's true.
That's when they can really pull some seats back.
Yeah, the timing of this. And I kind of got revolted the way they're all dancing on Rosa Parks' casket today. I mean, that drove me bananas, too, seeing what's his name, John Kerry up there. Oh, how she stood up for us. I'm like, wait a minute, she didn't stand up for you, John Kerry. She stood up for the African-Americans. And I'm like, oh, man, can't they, you know, and Jesse Jackson there getting riling them all up. I'm like, man, oh, man, did you watch that?
No. I paid my respects to Miss Parks on the site, and that was about it. I didn't really care to get involved with anything else. I think what she did was
heroic.
It was heroic, and she was the right person at the right time. I think a lot of people don't remember that there were other people who wouldn't get up, but she was just the right person to do it. She was. You know, she was a lifelong churchgoer. She was just a very, very good woman. And once the word started to spread about what had happened to Miss Parks, that's when it really started to get the ball rolling because everybody liked her.
Yeah.
She was a very good, decent human being, and people just didn't want her to be treated that way. And that was a catalyst for a lot of change in this country.
Yeah, I wonder how long it would be till we see a movie about her life with Oprah or something like that, huh? What do you think?
I honestly I don't know. I mean, like, you could see the movie, but apparently, like, she lived a very simple, plain life, so I don't know that there would necessarily be, like, a lot of interesting stories to tell. But hey, you never know. I mean, it might make a good TV movie on Oxygen or something.
Yeah, they could soap it up. And then also, you mentioned about Sam Alito. What's going on with him?
Well, you know, Harriet Myers withdrew.
Yes.
And you know, we talked last week, and I thought she was actually going to, they were actually going to drag it out to a confirmation hearing, but she just bowed out. I honestly don't think it was necessarily all her idea, but it's just one of those, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink things that happened in Washington. I mean, the writing was on the wall, and she wasn't getting along with the senators that she was meeting with. She wasn't impressing anybody, and going through a confirmation hearing where she might not have been able to give really good answers, that would have been extremely embarrassing for the president. I honestly think at the end of the day, she was just in over her head, and Bush thought she was a good woman, a very smart woman, but the Supreme Court isn't a place, really wasn't a place for Harriet Myers.
Well, yeah, they said she looked good on paper, but she lacked substance to be on the Supreme Court and constitutional law experience as well.
Yeah, and I was reading, like, she in her questionnaire that got sent back, there was, you know, some things that actually weren't correct about constitutional law. She was confusing some things, and that's not good. So she's out, and then pretty much immediately Samuel Alito gets nominated, and he seems like quite a legal scholar, to be perfectly blunt. I mean, he seems like a very, very, very intelligent, smart man. And he does seem in the mold of a Antonin Scalia, which, you know, a lot of people refer to him as, you know, by the nickname Scalito. I think at the end of the day, really what this nomination boils down to is Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
And I just saw a Gallup poll today where it was 53-37% 53% would be against his nomination if he did say, yes, I am against Roe v. Wade, and 37% would be for him. And it seems like basically the conservatives and the Republicans, and Gallup makes a distinction between the two, are really the only group that are with him if he's for Roe v. Wade. And that's to be expected, but the majority of the independents a majority of moderate and Democrats and liberals would not be for that. And they would actually be for a filibuster by 50 to 40%. So I think that's actually pretty telling. You know, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, his decision in Planned Parenthood v. Casey concerns me, and I wrote about that on the blog. I think that you know, when you have a law where somebody can hold some type of dominion over a woman's choice, and if a husband isn't notified, then she can't go through with the procedure. I think that interferes with her civil rights.
I don't know. If I was married, I'd like my wife to tell me she's getting an abortion versus just going off and doing it. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, well, you know, listen, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think that should be a decision between two people. I don't think that should be a decision that is legislated. I don't think that should be a decision that is legislated and for, you know, I mean, just think about this scenario. And this is a scenario that I heard, okay? Woman's husband essentially abandons her.
Mm.
All right? She's got a couple kids. She's got one on the way. And she knows that she can't support this. I mean, she's pretty much left destitute, all right? She was forced to go and find her husband to get to notify him that she was having an abortion under this Pennsylvania law. Okay? Mm. Now here's the thing, Sean. These laws are the problem with these laws is that these laws, like, they target those types of situations, right? And
yeah.
So you hear about these, like, you know, these awful, heart-wrenching situations. Well, you know what? You and your wife, I mean, I don't know if you're married or not, but
no.
You and your wife, okay, well, you're not, right? But if you were married, you would probably have a really good relationship with your wife, and you would sit down and talk about this decision,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I would hope so.
Yeah, and you know, and that's, and that I would think that, you know, if that would be the norm, right?
Yeah.
And if a woman wants to take upon herself to get an abortion without telling her husband, well, then there's probably a reason for it beyond just embarrassment.
Yeah. And then before we run out of time, we have talking about the Libby indictment too. That was something, huh? He's only
yeah.
One,
you know,
he's...
you know, I heard that there were going to be more. It looks like Roe is still under investigation. Roe told something like Fitzgerald something at, you know, the 11th hour, and it kind of made him pull the grand jury back in. But yeah, Libby is indicted and Libby is out, and people are trying to make light of the indictment now. You know, pretty much as expected. But listen, it's perjury and it's obstruction of justice. I mean, that's it.
Well,
you know,
it's also very Clinton-esque.
Well, all that aside, that'll be figured out by, you know, the people that are going to be actually prosecuting him for the perjury. But first
right.
off, at the very, very heart of the entire subject, got one question for you. Why, what was the guy's name, Joe Walsh, or not no, Joe Walsh, but
Joe Wilson.
Joe Wilson.
There you go.
Why was I saying Walsh? I don't know. Why was his wife the one that asked him to come over there? Okay, that's question number one, but it all encompasses into a larger picture. He goes over there. We pay him to go over there and do an investigation. He comes back, writes a book, he writes an op-ed piece. Are we paying this guy to be a politicize everything? No,
yeah.
We're not.
Yeah.
We're paying him to go over there, do a job. It was supposed to be a secret report to be given to Congress, and everybody was supposed to see it over there for this whole big investigation. He should not be writing about it. If anything, that guy right there is the one that should be being prosecuted right now, right alongside Libby. Because if Libby lied, take him to the goddamn chopping block. If he's going to lie in front of a jury, I'm the first one to say, you know, put him in jail for it, because I'm tired of these people doing stuff like that. But first off, why is the CIA involved in doing that, and especially the guy's wife? And why are we paying him to write op-ed pieces in the New York Times?
Yeah, he wrote
well,
books.
Well, we aren't paying him to write op-ed pieces. He wrote that of his own accord. And Joe Wilson isn't the target of these investigations. I mean, if trust me, all right, if Joe Wilson had committed a crime, they would have gone after him. You know, if he had, like, you know, breached some sort of, like, you know, if he had, you know, talked about classified information. But the thing about it is Bush had talked about it in the State of the Union address. And after that, it's fair game, you know? So, you know, somebody, I would imagine that's why they did not go after
okay.
Joe Wilson.
He,
because the information was made public by the President of the United States.
Okay, well, that was part of it. But what he wrote in the op-ed piece is nearly opposite of what his actual report was. And it was basically this. They knew that the Iraqis went there. They knew they were looking for the yellow cake.
Yellow cake, right.
Yeah, they were looking for it.
Yeah.
They do not know for certain one way or the other if they got it or they didn't, because nobody knew over there. He flat out said in that op-ed piece that they didn't. And you know what? That's still an up-in-the-air question. They don't know, because that country over there is sitting there, like, trying to figure out how much they had before and how much they had after, and they don't have anywhere close to exact figures. They're within,
Niger?
Yeah, they're within something like 100 tons or 10 tons on either side both times. Huh. So it's like they don't even know if they gave it to him or not. So this guy can't do this.
I think talking in absolutes gets people in trouble.
Yeah, and
I mean,
it should get him in trouble.
That's just how it is. But, you know, one of the things that he went over there to investigate was a certain, you know, like, document. And the document was an obvious forgery, you know. And so that's kind of the heart of the issue, too. I mean, you have this document that's an obvious forgery. They sent him over to, like, check this specific report out. And it was, like, it was written by, like, some Italian. You know, and there was some sort of, like, you know, Italian connection or something.
Well,
I mean,
the other thing that the guy didn't actually make mention of at all, and he only wrote a very minuscule part about it in a rebuttal statement to someone else's talking to him. He wrote it somewhere. I can't remember where it was now. But there was actually two other investigation teams over there that have not leaked any of their information, have not written op-ed pieces in the New York Times, and those reports are still sitting there waiting for this investigation to be over to be made public. And this guy, I tell you what, you just watch. When this investigation's over, they're going to put charges against him for doing the leaking, because he admitted full out that he was the leak to that first reporter. He was the leak. Flat out said it.
Really?
Yeah, I leaked it.
The leak to, are you talking about?
Not
the
about the CIA
thing,
but about the
right.
about the yellow cake stuff. He wasn't supposed to be saying anything about that. And the only reason he's getting away with it right now is because the investigation isn't over. And they're not going to go into figuring out what happened in the investigation and the leaks from it until the investigation's over. You're not going to have
two
special prosecuting teams going on at the same time about one subject. It's not going to happen.
Well, hey, listen, I mean, like, if he committed a crime, then you know, he should be prosecuted. I mean, that's just all there is to it. But I really thought that because Bush had talked about that specific stuff in his State of the Union address, it was then public knowledge. I could be mistaken.
That one tiny instance of it. He didn't say where they got it from or anything, or like not where, but how much or anything like that. And where the information came from, and this is what this guy leaked. He leaked everything.
Well, then Justin, he's
going to get his just desserts, just like, I mean, even though everything's been, like, way overboard and done over the hilt, Libby should never have gotten into this position to begin with, but he did, and he made a mistake, and now he's going to pay for it.
Unless he gets pardoned or something. Do you think Bush will pardon him?
Do I think Bush will pardon him?
No.
You know, I think that if he does, there's going to be a lot of angry Republicans.
Well, they went through the same thing with Clinton. There's nothing they can do. I mean, once they pardon him, he can't go back and fix it, right?
Well, there's one other thing I just want to mention real quick. There's also 20 other investigative reports from other countries about this exact incident, and none of that stuff has gotten released either. So we don't even know if this guy is the only one that said, no, this wasn't real. We have no idea. There's two of the exact same people. He was, or, you know, three, him being one of them, that went over there to look for this one exact thing, and then there was 20 other countries that did it too. So we'll find out once this is all over if this is one big, you know, political hailstorm trying to just take down one person out of the cabinet just for political BS or not.
Well, please do me a favor, and I haven't heard about the 20 other countries. Do me a favor and go ahead and send me the link on that, because this is new information.
Yeah, it was actually, the guy that just filled in for Hannity today was reading it off, and I went to their website, and there was something on it there. I have to grab it back up. It was right down in the middle of an article.
Well, and then they re-air Hannity and Combs in a couple hours, so you might be able to grab me on, say, your VCR and record it from there.
Well, it was the guy filling in for him. It was on the radio.
Show.
Yeah.
Well, I know.
The
Hannity
stuff that came out today, actually.
Yeah, Hannity podcast is his show, so you might be able to find it. I also want to congratulate you on your 4,000 hits yesterday, huh?
Oh, that was pretty wild. We were like the first. We're on the first results page on Google when you typed in Samuel Alito. So,
well, congratulations!
Yeah,
good for you. Good for you.
Yeah. No, it was pretty exciting. I woke up and you know, by like 9:30, it was up to 1,000 visits,
wow.
And it was insane. So,
well,
that's the power of Google.
Yeah. Well, Justin, we're going to let you go. We have our Andrew Evans from the American Centrist Party. Maybe you shall get together with him, huh?
Hey, maybe.
Centrist blog with the Centrist Party. You never know. So, all right, Justin, thank you very much.
All right, man. Have a good week.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And that was Justin Gardner of the Dunkelfant blog. And hopefully we'll be getting our call from Andrew Evans from the American Centrist Party. And we'll be talking about the new third party. And hopefully... that's probably him calling right there. Hey, I like this timing here. The timing is wonderful on this program tonight, I tell you. And, oops, that's not working here. And I'm trying to pull up the website, but I'm having problems. Sometimes I have a problem pulling up this American Centrist Party website for some reason. I don't know if it's the something with the site or what there, but here it comes now. And actually, I didn't give away my tidbit about myself in the first hour, so I'll give it away. My middle name is Michael, and then the tidbit in the second hour, my first dog was named Mopsy. So those are my two tidbits for tonight. And we're joined by Andrew Evans, of the Vice Chairman of the American Centrist Party. Andrew, are you there, sir?
Yes, sir. How you doing, sir?
Hi. Sorry for the delay there. We kind of ran over with the first hour guest, and we kind of ran over with the second hour guest, so I apologize for that.
Not a problem. Must be a good show.
Well, it is. Well, we're just it's a couple emotional issues, and but anyway, welcome you to the program.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And now you're the vice chairman, right, of the party?
That's correct.
Correct.
National vice chairman.
Absolutely. And I had Matt Unger on about a month or so ago, and went over very well. And people are asking to bring him back. Now, give everybody in a nutshell what the American Centrist Party is all about.
Well, basically what the American Centrist Party is, of course, we're a new third party, but we've only been around for about a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what the ACP is trying to do, of course, trying to give people back their voice in government. The thing is, of course, the Republican Democratic parties, both of them have their good points and also their negative points. The main problem that a lot of your major parties have today is they're listening more to special interests than to the actual people.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing personally that I see that's going on in our government today, one reason that actually drove me to join the American Centrist Party was the fact that no one in our government seems to be focusing on what actually unites us as Americans. We're also worried about, everybody has different values, worried about, okay, is this the solution, is that the solution?
Mm-hmm.
But we're not really focusing on what unites us. We're not focusing on what we have in common. We're not focusing on the common ground that we can build from to make America better.
Exactly. I've said that when I had Matt on, too, that you know these two, the Democrats and Republicans are preaching to the choir and they're pulling everybody left or right. I mean, they're like this thing with Reid and the secret session, all that was BS. I mean, it's crazy. How much money did that cost us to do that? The American taxpayers paid for that secret session of Congress for what?
It's insane. It's just a political mind job. That's really all it is. It's just like two kids in the sandbox.
Uh-huh.
And Reid just like, no, that's my Tonka toy. You know, I'm going to bring this over here. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, Republicans are whining about that. And whether it was the actual rule that, you know, that he could do that or not, you know, that's not really the issue. The issue is that going to actually help anything be solved? No,
yeah.
It's not. Because it's going to take the focus off the main problems we have in our nation, of
mm-hmm.
course, right now, which is Iraq. Also, you know, health care. voter fraud, things of that nature. One thing I see a lot in our political situation today is the Democrats and the Republicans both, you know, they vaguely address the main issues, and then they try to put forth minor issues. For example, I mean, at the end of last campaign, during the presidential campaign, the Republican administration did a great job at the end, you know, focusing everybody on gay marriage. Like, oh, well, let's get everybody afraid about gay marriage, when the real issue should have been Iraq, the economy, and things of that nature. But, of course, no, let's put it on an issue that is important, but one that's not necessarily going to break the camel's back.
No, no, we need you know, the issues that matter to everybody, like educating our children. Like I've said for years that we need all these schools in the country to be 12-month schools, because we're educating a legion of idiots that are going to be running the country shortly. I mean, that's my thinking, because we're falling behind Japan and all these Asian countries, because for some reason we're stuck with, you know, we're still in the mindset of the, you know, 1800s with these 9-month year schools. It's ridiculous.
Exactly.
You know?
Right now, currently, we're ranked 7th overall. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you look at it in the grand scheme of things, we're like, okay, 7th isn't bad out of, you know, how many odd number of countries are out there. But if you think about it, this is America.
Yes.
I mean, we have the world's greatest military by far. And of course, I'm not saying anything bad about the military, but we do spend $100 billion more a year than the next 32 nations combined. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody's going to touch us on that. Mm-hmm. The thing is, what we need to do as a nation, every person, what's great about America is every person has the ability to make themselves who they want to be. But what we need to do as a nation, on all levels of government, local, federal, state, whatever, we need to give our children a good base education. And that's not being done. It's not fair when some child, whether it be white, black, Hispanic, or whatever, just because they live in one part of the city and their tax base isn't as high as, say, some child who lives out in the suburbs, they're not getting access to computer education. Currently where I live in eastern North Carolina, there's some students who don't even have books.
Wow.
And teachers have to print off the homework assignments, but then again, they only get a certain amount of paper to use per year.
Horrible.
So sometimes the students don't even get homework assignments. And of course, I know I was in school, I didn't like doing homework.
Yeah.
But of course, without that, how are you going to get a good basic education?
Exactly.
You're not. The thing is, the money's there, the money's not a problem. We have dedicated teachers. We have dedicated people on the boards of education. The thing is, what we need to do is we need to focus on what made America great to begin with. That is, of course, is education and innovation. For example, in our economy, everybody's worried about China and India. It's only natural for China and India's economies to grow. They have billions more people than we do. Numbers-wise, it's only natural, just a matter of time as they industrialize. But the thing is, what we're losing sight of, what made America's economy great? Education and innovation. With innovation, we need to keep research, and we need to find the new industries that are going to create the jobs of tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, things are changing. America's textile industry isn't what it used to be. That's a big issue here in North Carolina. Of course, your manufacturing jobs, you know, aren't what they used to be.
Well, there are none. They're all gone, aren't they?
They're being offshored. And the thing is, when you hear the administration saying that offshoring is good for America, you know, we are part of a global economy, but, you know, until the rest of the world, you know, learns to be unselfish, and America, too, until we're all like, okay, let's all get along, we need to make sure that American interests come first.
Absolutely. I'm on the part of the site about the sensible tax infrastructure, where you're advocating we don't pay any federal tax. We pay all our taxes to the state, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, multi-layers of taxation should be left to the career civil servants, and the average citizen should only have to pay taxes once. I mean, that's a brilliant idea. So then the federal government would actually get the tax from the states, correct?
Exactly. And if you read the Constitution, and if you really look at it literally, that's really how it's set up. Is the states put in to the federal government what they take out. For example, you know, the states put in equally for defense. But and one thing I know Matt and I have talked about this, and it's also on the website too. You know, it's not, if you think about it, it's not really fair for one state to have a high tax burden, say on a certain social program, when most of their citizens might not be getting benefits from that social program, whereas another state, possibly a larger state, is getting that benefit.
Yeah.
They should pay more in. Things such as defense, we should pay in equally. But I mean, you look at the IRS. The IRS's budget is huge. It's a monster, and it just complicates things. Like, you know, there's this new thing about the tax code they're talking about doing. Mm-hmm. You know, it does need to be changed. And by having that one stop, if there are problems with your taxes, you know who to contact.
Exactly.
They can contact you. Instead of dealing with four different people, you're dealing with one or maybe two people.
And also, the ACP is proposing auditing the federal government from the bottom up. I mean, I think that's been coming for years. I mean, I know Gore advocates some kind of a Clinton, when he was in, he had Gore do some kind of a federal government, whatever it was. But I think you need to go do a top-to-bottom audit of the entire federal government to get rid of all this waste, huh?
You have to, Sean, because look at it. If you and I go over our budget, what happens to us?
Yeah.
We're in the negative.
Yeah.
Okay, we're broke for a while. We can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, credit rating might suffer, things of this nature. Our federal government, okay, oh, we went over. Let's just print some more money, or let's just borrow some more and put it to our $7.9 trillion national debt and our $300, $400, $500 billion deficit. It's not right. It's fiscally insane.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, we need to audit. We need to see what programs are working, what programs need to be changed,
exactly,
what programs need to be eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
There's this one law that came in effect, I think, under the Carter administration, the Sunshine Law. And what it is I believe, I forget the exact set number of years, but every so often, programs come up for review to Congress,
mm-hmm,
whether to get a yes or no to keep funding them, and if they're making, you know, certain, you know, cost to benefit ratio progress.
Yeah.
Nowadays, that Sunshine Law is just a rubber stamp.
Hmm.
You know, of course it's going to get passed through. There's no real debate. There's no real investigation or anything.
Yeah. And then I'm also on the part about putting an order back in the border, because after tonight, an hour after my program goes off the air, I'm going over to the local radio station to do it's called a Wake Up America program. It's a show that does talks about illegal immigration. And let's see, you're talking about the military's got to be able to, back up the Border Patrol to enforce their borders, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, the main thing the ACP wants to get eventually is a border security force,
mm-hmm,
whether it be, you know, using the National Guard. I think also, you know, increasing recruitment to get people into a certain border security force. The thing is, every nation has sovereign borders.
Mm-hmm.
It's our right to protect ours. I have no problem with legal immigrants coming through. North Carolina, the state where I'm in, we have a bunch of them. Hardworking people,
mm-hmm,
they just want to take care of their families just like any other average American.
That's right.
But the thing is, it's not right for the American taxpayer to be footing the bill for illegal immigrants to come through.
Yeah.
For example, I know some churches here in North Carolina are actually having classes for illegal immigrants to learn how to, you know, kind of weasel their way around the system to get, you know, Social Security, you know, health benefits, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And really, seriously, it's a national security threat.
Oh, yeah.
Because with a border that's porous like that, how can you monitor what's going on?
Absolutely. Well, that and you got this bird flu. What's to stop, you know, like Al Qaeda, giving a bunch of people, inject them with the bird flu and sending them across the border from Mexico into the United States? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
We have an epidemic across the country. I think we got to do that. And then, and also there's the issue of the Posse Comitatus Act. But that would be the military would just be backing up the border patrol if they're running the problems. We wouldn't be actually interfacing with that, you know, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
we definitely need to do something about our border.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I think it's coming to this point where if the federal government's not going to do it, I think you're actually going to see coalitions of border states get together and pool their money and their resources.
Yeah, well, they did that, New Mexico?
Governor Richardson did that.
Yeah, he did it, and then the governor of Arizona, she did it. And then I was listening to the radio show last night, and they say now there's the patrols on the border of Arizona and Mexico now with armored vehicles now from the United States. So I'm like, how come we're not hearing about this? You know?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true or not. I mean, that's what I heard on that radio show. So I'll find out when I get down there if it's true or not. But I mean, it's an issue that has to be addressed, especially with this bird flu. I mean, and that's something that everybody should be worried about.
I mean, that's the last thing we need over
there,
especially with all the natural disasters we've been having. Because America, if you look at it, we're woefully unprepared. I mean, Bush just initiated this plan, $7.1 billion,
mm-hmm,
and it sounds great, but the thing is, of course, as with anything with government, people aren't perfect, but the thing is, it's going to take time.
Yeah.
It's going to be about 2010 before this is fully realized, and at first, the initial vaccines are only going to vaccinate 20 million people.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
We have to do something.
Exactly. And then also you mentioned about reining in the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, about the immediate cancellation of the indecency fine, an executive order preventing future usurpation of the First Amendment rights by the FCC. Absolutely. If you don't like what's being on a program, turn the thing off. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Right. I mean, and Sean, how hard is it? You know, we have the ratings thing on TV, you know, when you watch a program now. Every so often, they'll have the little thing up on the top, TV 14, MSLA, whatever. Mm. Why can't we have that for a radio station, like during commercials? Like, take 20 seconds, right, come
That's
back
true.
Commercial. This program has language, blah, blah, blah,
yeah.
blah.
Yeah, I mean.
So that way you let people know. I mean, but you're right. If you don't like it, change the station.
Yeah. Once again, this is Sean O'Mac, subject to discussion with Andrew Evans, the vice chairman of the American Centrist Party. A question for the chairman. Where has Matt Unger been?
Actually, I do not know. I've been
wow.
trying to get in touch with myself. I'm sure he's just pretty much bogged down with work. But
he's all right.
Pretty busy with the website and everything. I know that's for sure.
Yeah. And also you support the troops. They're bringing home the deployed combat troops, closing foreign bases, decreasing foreign adventurism, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and immediate pay increase. That's right. We just had Colby Bazell on there, and in his book, he mentions how poorly paid these troops are. I mean, this is ridiculous. I thought we resolved that. Didn't Clinton and Bush address that?
They supposedly did. What's really sad is I've actually heard stories where, and this of course affects the National Guard, where of course the husband or the father, the husband, father, or the mother, mm-hmm. overseas fighting, for America. Meanwhile. Due to mix up in pay or decrease in pay, their families are actually losing their mortgages back home. So they come home and there's no home left. And that's, to me, that's intolerable.
Yeah.
The thing is, we have to learn how to respect our military. Our military has been stretched way too thin for too long. When they're not getting the proper equipment, the proper training, and the proper housing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to a military base before, Sean, but mm-hmm. a lot of the housing still looks like it's from the 1950s.
Horrible.
I mean, it's absolutely deplorable.
Yeah, it's horrible. I've always said we should pay these people with the responsibility that they have. They're defending our country. They should be among the highest paid professions we have. Same thing with the teachers, the firemen, and the cops.
Exactly.
I mean, it's ludicrous. And also the numbers you have on the AmericanCentristParty.com website about canceling the F-22 program, it would save $71 billion. Canceling the V-22 program would save 17. I mean, of course you won't be able to I don't know if all this can be canceled or not, but I mean, just the savings, if all this would come true, it's $146 billion a year.
Exactly.
And we could plow that money into schools, education, or fixing our roads.
Deficit would be gone in
2 years. Yeah.
Deficit would be gone in 2 years.
Wow.
What's really interesting is the Osprey's been in development for, I mean, I grew up in Virginia Beach, which is a big, big Navy area. And, of course, the Osprey has been in development for years. And the military needs something like that to fulfill its need, but the thing is, the Osprey has just shown time and time again that it is a faulty machine, and they just need to scratch it. And like you said, with the bringing the troops home, what we want to do is we don't want to bring every single troop home because of course that's going to put us at a disadvantage. But we don't have quick reaction forces. Where, say, God forbid, if something breaks out in Asia, over Taiwan, we have a group of troops that can go there, hold the ground until we bring our mass troops in. Because right now, we're basically financing Japan's defense. And that's billions and billions of dollars a year. They're chipping in a little bit, but that's billions and billions of dollars a year. And we just can't afford to do it all. We seriously can't.
Now, a question for Chairman. What is the state of the party?
The party is doing really well. Right now, the party is currently expanding. We have committees in New England, committees in Midwest. Currently, I'm the state chairman for North Carolina. Also, I'm the interim chairman for Virginia. I'm training a good friend of mine to take over for the chairmanship. And I think pretty soon we're going to have state committees in South Carolina, also in Georgia, probably within the next couple months.
Wow.
On the national level right now, what we're looking at is we're, of course, looking at into ways of fundraising. Also, we're getting registered. We're getting everything mobilized in the individual states to get registered on the ballots. And we're, of course, looking for people interested in running for the local offices. I was actually bantering about myself running for city council
in
the town where I live. But I decided against that. But next time comes around, I am going to run for city council.
Yeah. Why not? I know I put on the message board that I think the party should come up with a blog to keep an update on what's going on with the party on about daily or weekly or something like that.
Definitely,
you know, blogs are so popular right now. I mean, you know, pretty much all the parties do. So, like I said, yours should be called the Median or something like that. You're centrist, they'll call it the Median or something. I don't know. And nothing in Nevada yet, huh? I'll have to see. How about Mark here? Do you want to be run the ACP Nevada branch here, Mark? The producer?
NAACP?
No, the ACP.
Well, you know, I probably would.
There you go.
Because I'm literally just about
fed up and a half
there we go.
With two... Two political parties is just so ripe for every single kind of problem you could ever have.
Yeah.
So tired of it.
They're just so it's so crazy.
Yeah.
You look at our life in America, we have so many choices. Like you can go to the grocery store and you can buy literally probably 32 different types of cheeses. But then when it comes to politics, you have Republican
two.
Or Democrat.
Yeah. And
it's either right or left. You know, either agree completely with this or completely with that. Mm. There's no logical, you know, moderate party out there, except for ACP, you know, and some other ones.
Yeah.
And the movement truly is growing, and people are starting to wake up. And I mean, the main thing that we can do in the ACP is we as Americans, we have such busy lives. The thing is just try to take a little bit of time, just find out what's going on in your local government, and just put your voice out there, even just a little bit. Mm. You know, big movements start with just a little bit of effort, and that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Now, people are asking about the American Centrist Party. Now, you're looking at now, what's a sign of progress? I mean, do you just want to influence the discussion of the big two parties, or do you actually want to see the party actually become a major stakeholder in the country?
I think the party eventually is going to become a major stakeholder in the country. Mm-hmm. Like I said, right now, of course, we're just starting off, and of course, the movement always takes time.
Mm-hmm.
We are influencing the discussion. I mean, of course, you look at the blogs, you look at all this stuff. People are waking up. People are taking a look and realizing that the two-party system is not working for America.
Yeah.
Most of your other, Western nations, for example, have multiple political parties. The reason why that is because, you know, people want options. People don't necessarily agree 100% with this party or 100% with that party. They want a party that's going to be more inclusive and going to work together to find out a rational solution to something. The ACP, I think, eventually is going to be, I'd say probably within the next 10 years, we could seriously probably have some state and possibly congressional representatives. I really think it's that strong.
Wow.
Because I know several people in the party are seriously considering running for the offices. Like I said, you know, next time city council comes around from my area, I'm going to run for that. And there's actually another lady who I'm familiar with, a great woman. She's actually going to be running for city council for a neighboring city as well. And we're going to sit down, me and my vice chairman, David, we're going to sit down, we're going to talk with her, try to get a little bit more of her philosophy and help her iron out a little bit more of a platform, and hopefully we'll be able to support her as well.
Well, hopefully. I mean, because like I said, I was a member of the Reform Party when it first started here in here in Vegas, and then now they've been infighting for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years now over the party. It's a mess. And then I looked at the website here, and I saw, you know, some of the views are similar, which I liked, and yet you don't have the infighting that the Reform Party has, you know, thanks to Pat Buchanan and some of the others. They just tore the party apart. But,
and that's what we don't want the ACP. I mean, the thing is we want to be inclusive. We don't want to, you know, deny people. But the thing is we have to realize that, you know, we're not going to be far right. We're not going to be far left.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is we want to come to a moderate, progressive decision. We want to come up with solutions that work for everybody.
Yeah.
And, of course, that can be hard. We're not trying to please everybody because you can't do that. But the thing is, let's compromise. Let's come to agreement on issues. Be like, okay, I can take this. Maybe I don't agree with that, but you know what? I realize the people I'm working with are trying to do what I'm trying to do, which is make America and our communities better.
Exactly.
Like with the Reform Party, like you said, it's really sad what's happened. And that's one thing we're also going to be working on national-wise is pretty soon we're going to be probably working on an actual constitution, which, of course, is going to have binding bylaws and also give us more structure, too, which, of course, we need as we're growing more and more. Here in North Carolina, we already have one. We've worked on that. And Virginia, we're going to be working on one as well. And the thing is, we just need to keep getting more boots in the ground, which is what we've been doing, and just keep getting the word out there. So the party's definitely moving in the right direction. And
I hope so. Yeah, I think I'm the first talk show host to actually be a member, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Really glad about that.
Yeah, yeah. I really liked when Matt was on, and you've been very enlightening as well. It just it's good. I mean, we may not all agree about all the issues and the stands of the party, but a few key ones, bringing the country back to its founding roots, and let's take care of the country here for once for crying out loud. You know what I'm saying?
That's right. Let me throw this at you real quick. This is something you might want to actually take a look at, and hopefully some of the listeners will too. Mm. Of course, I was just surfing around and do my Google thing. A really, really neat website I came across, which it's actually a national budget simulation, where you can actually look at either short or long version of the federal budget.
Really?
And you can adjust spending completely, like raise it 100% or cut it 100% and all the intervals in between.
Wow.
It's www.nathannewman.com. All one word, .org.
Nathan Newman? How does he spell Newman?
N-E-W-M-A-N. And it's a /NBS/. It's a national budget simulation.
NathanNewman.org?
Uh-huh. For example, I've been on there several times, and just cutting back about 10% here and there on certain programs, mainly the actual government running itself, such as the executive branch, legislative branch, and cutting back some on the tax cuts, not eliminating them completely, but just cutting back some.
Yeah.
I've already decreased the deficit by about $100 billion.
Well, not only that, but see, I liked it when Clinton was in, because he had the Republican House battling him, and it was gridlock because nothing got done. They weren't able to pass new laws or new taxes, and actually the deficit went down the fastest it ever went down was during that time when the Clinton was in and the Republicans were.